Welcome to Ohio Matters, the Cleveland.com politics podcast. I'm Seth Richardson.
I'm Andrew Tobias.
And as always, thanks for tuning in. Special thanks goes out to the Cleveland Public Library for helping us out with this podcast. They give us the room. They set up all the equipment. We really appreciate Mike and Brian's work here. They are great partners to have. As always, if you haven't yet, subscribe to this podcast. And when you do that, be sure to rate and review us. It helps other people find this show. And we always, you know, welcome new listeners into the Ohio Matters family. And if you have any feedback or you want to suggest any guests, anything like that, go ahead and send that on to my email. That's srichardson@cleveland.com. Again, that's srichardson@cleveland.com. This week on the pod, drumroll please, we are going to welcome back guest host Rich Exner. He's the data guru over at cleveland.com. Rich, how you doing?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me today.
And what we're going to do this time is we're going to break down the special election that just happened in the 12th district. There's a lot of interesting stuff that came out of there, you know, that kind of points us toward the midterms that are going to happen in November. For those of you who don't know and weren't glued to cable news or to cleveland.com on Tuesday night, Troy Balderson, the Republican in that district, a Republican state senator, ended up squeaking out the slimmest of victories against Democratic Franklin County recorder Danny O'Connor. Now, the results are not official just yet, but barring some kind of miracle with provisional ballots, it looks like Troy Balderson is going to win that race. What's notable about that race is that it is a pretty heavy Republican district, and we still saw Danny O'Connor do really well. Rich, I believe you did a full precinct breakdown of basically the whole district. You want to just kind of start off by telling us what sort of trends you saw in that race?
Well, just back up for a bit. For people that aren't familiar, this is a district that has a portion of Franklin County, being mainly Columbus. It has a northern portion of that, so you get that type of people that live both in Columbus and in the suburbs. But as you go further out, it extends over towards Zanesville, Muskingum County, and it extends north toward Mansfield, yeah, up into Richland County.
And I always thought it's kind of funny, like the sort of assessment of that district, it gets described as suburban Columbus, and for all I know, I've done that too. It's kind of like a shorthand, but like you were saying, I mean, Zanesville is basically like Appalachia light, you know, up to Mansfield, and that area is very farmland. Yeah. So if you actually look at the district, it's kind of like anchored by Columbus, and then it kind of waves off into weird directions, pretty much the north and the east.
It's one of those districts they wanted to offset some of the more Democratic voters there in Franklin County with, you know, all the rural areas that you just talked about. It's a very oddly shaped one.
It's a little wacky.
Yeah. Well, I think that there was even some discussion, you know, we don't want somebody from Franklin County representing us during the campaign, but there's a reason that Franklin County's in that district is that it made other Republican districts Republican by keeping enough Democrats in that they thought were safe, I guess, until this election, because that district hasn't been closed since those lines that we just talked about were drawn back in 2011.
So what are you seeing in some of the precinct profiles from the voters?
Well, it's very heavy. It's not surprising that the Columbus area, both the portions in Columbus and the immediate suburbs, tended to be more Democrat, but to the extent of so, you really see a divide. It's like all these precincts that on the southern tip of the district that darts down into Columbus are 70%, 80%, 90% Democrat in this. But then you get out in some of the more rural areas, like we said, in Muskingum County or north of Columbus, and it's 70%, 80%, 90% Republican. I guess it's a lot of, I don't know whether it's always been the case, but a lot about what we hear about politics these days is people living in their silos where they're so sharply divided. There aren't too many middle of the ground places, or it seems like it's really dominated by, you know, strong one way or the other, not a healthy debate in between.
I think the county probably everybody in America knows about right now is Delaware County. That is the county that is just north of Columbus. It's still a suburban Columbus county, though, a real Republican stronghold. I mean, it's probably venturing into meme territory at this place. Actually, probably one of the best tweets I saw is that Delaware County is the actual Waukesha County of Ohio. So, but it was a very crucial county to this race. You know, it's usually a 60-40 district, kind of at best. I mean, Republicans have kind of trended down slightly, but, you know, it went real big for Donald Trump. So let's look at that number real quick while we do. And, you know, this is going to sound like it's a significant victory for the Republicans. You got Troy Balderson, who took 53, about 54% of the district. or of that county, and you have Danny O'Connor pulling in with 46%. That seems like the significant factor in what kind of pushed O'Connor almost to victory there.
You know, Andrew, who worked in Delaware County for a while, would probably know better than I, but my feeling is that Delaware County is becoming a lot less like old Delaware County by the year, and not just what, you know, we've oftentimes talked, it's the richest county in Ohio in terms of, like, you know, economics, most highly educated, but it's also, it's becoming more suburban Columbus as that happens. So, you know, the county line does not change over the years, but as people move out from Franklin County, do they necessarily become more Republican, or does that mean more Democrats are moving in there?
Yeah, and it's basically shifting from a rural sort of dynamic to a suburban dynamic, and both those groups tend to be Republican-leaning, although I guess in today's Republican Party, it's obviously the suburban voters who are kind of more up for grabs these days.
But it's interesting you pointed out how close, I guess, so to speak, that the county was on that election, and you go a little bit south into Franklin County, and I think the vote margin, you know, remember district-wide, this thing is within, you know, less than 2,000 votes. But in Franklin County, the portion there, it was better than 20,000 in favor of the Democrats. So it still was really, you know, that portion around Columbus for the most part, that versus the rest of the district, and kind of balancing out to make this thing so close.
Yeah, so it sounds like what you're saying is that Balderson basically did the same as Trump when it comes to the more outlying rural areas, but in the suburban areas, O'Connor would have had to outperform Clinton, right?
Right. And I think one thing that was surprising we came across in looking at the precincts results that are the unofficial ones now, and we weren't able to do it for Licking County because for some reason Licking County decides that they don't report precinct results until they're official.
But the bane of every political reporter's existence now. They hadn't heard of you before Licking County, but you're on their bad list now.
We're calling Licking County out. Give us the results.
Yes, give us the results now. But in the other counties that in looking at the precincts, it's not surprising where Balderson carried 60, 70, 80%. It's like what you would expect, and the same way the other way around for O'Connor. But what was interesting was, okay, basically a lot of Franklin County were these very high Democratic precincts. Well, did they get everybody out? Is everybody enthused? Well, if you take a look back to the last off-year congressional election there 4 years ago, overall the turnout wasn't entirely different than what we had in a special election, which is pretty high for a special election, but I think it was roughly 225,000 votes were cast 4 years ago, and there were just over 200,000 in this one.
So that's the general in 2014 compared to the special this year, right?
And that's a non-presidential year because it was more in a presidential year, of course. But in that case, we're the Democrat ran the strongest. It was up a smidget in those places, but it wasn't like overwhelming changes. It wasn't like a lot more people showed up. And where Balderson Republican ran the strongest in those outlying areas, it was down some, but not a lot. But there's still, if you look at the election in between, there's a heck of a lot of voters out there, the potential for each of them to tap going forward. But it wasn't like the Republican vote completely dropped off the map from what Trump did in terms of percent.
Yeah.
Or the Democrat in that area. It shifted some, but not by huge amounts. So there's other things going on. Other things move this vote, too.
Well, I think that's actually really important because there's this kind of outstanding question about to what degree are Trump voters also going to vote for other Republicans too, right? Like, can he transfer his popularity to other candidates? And so in this case, I would be very encouraged if I were a Republican looking at across the state, despite all the reasons why they have to be worried. I guess one of the things that they can kind of hang their hat on is that those Trump voters are hanging with them, which, you know, is obviously a good thing since their party's basically anchored to him.
Yeah, I guess it's a question of if holding on to those Trump voters and just those Trump voters is going to be successful going into the future because, you know, as you know, the guy is underwater in the polls here in Ohio. And I mean, I think some of that did show up as well. That's probably why he had such a close race. I mean, it's easy to say you're going to hold on to just the Trump voters, but is the Trump coalition big enough to carry you to continued success, or does it turn some of these, you know, what used to be reliably Republican places, does it start turning them a little more swingy as people are kind of turned off by that brand of politics?
Two things along that line. So one last thing on the turnout and whether people are enthusiastic enough to show up. Now, if you compare this special election to the presidential election, where of course more people voted, like twice as many voted. But still, if you look at the precincts where I kind of honed in on the precincts where each candidate got at least 70% of the vote. If you look at the 57 precincts where Balderson got at least 70% of the vote, 15,000 fewer people showed up to vote than voted, you know, in the presidential election. Well, if you look at the same thing on O'Connor, in this case it was 61 precincts, so basically the same number. 15,000 fewer people showed up to vote than voted 2 years ago in the presidential election. So both of them hold potential. The voters are out there on their party.
Yeah.
So they both have potential if they can get to those people. But then the other thing I noticed, too, overall in the vote, not necessarily on the precinct, but just talking overall, is that a lot's been said about how Trump beat Clinton by, I think it was 10.3 points in this district, and that now this was, you know, basically one percentage point difference, now shade under that, that the gap really closed. But when you look at it, remember we had a lot of third party votes in the presidential election, and you don't have that here. The Republican vote only dropped off from like something like 52% to 50, where the so it's not like people left. I want to say percentage wise, it's not like the Republicans have lost their hold. They lost a couple percentage points, and the Democratic vote came up about 7.5 points, mostly picking that up out of that third party proportion.
So let's look at going into November for just this election. We'll get to some of the other races and some of the broader ramifications in just a second. But what is each candidate, I guess, you know, from your analysis, you looked at sort of the districts and what they mean. And in your piece that came out this week kind of details where, you know, each candidate maybe could do better and basically who they need to turn out. Where are you seeing, like, where does O'Connor need to turn out to win this district in November? And where does Balderson need to turn out to sort of stop any, you know, any kind of upset?
If I'm thinking about turnout, if I'm either candidate, I think I'm thinking the time is spent on that where you support strongest. So if you get 50 people to turn out in a place where it's 80% you have a better chance to pick up votes, right? Well, I think that starts at the across the street from Ohio State University for O'Connor, because all those precincts, that the way this district's drawn, it almost shoots down like a knife into that section of Columbus from the north. But all those precincts were 70, 80, 90% for O'Connor. But students aren't there in the summer. This is not on campus, but off campus to the east of campus and north of what people familiar with Ohio State, north of, say, Fraternity Row. Those students go back to school in 2 weeks. So there's some time for a couple of months to try to say, hey, register to vote here instead of, you know, vote here instead of absentee from wherever you might live outside the district. So that, I would think that would hold the potential. You got a campus of 50 or 60,000 students. Just geographically, it looks like maybe a third of them or a quarter of them that live off of campus live in this district. So there's a potential there. And then extending north, anywhere in Franklin County, it's fairly strong, but there's a whole swath of land going from basically north of campus up to the county line in Delaware County that O'Connor ran incredibly strong. So if you can up those numbers there, that works.
I know one of the things that I was kind of thinking about going into this election was thinking that it'd be lower turnout. So then they always say special elections are special, and it's not that all special elections aren't, or it's not that all elections aren't special. It's special elections are more special than others. Anyways, so, but the idea is that basically the low turnout, kind of the high intensity of the base voters who do show up to vote for those kinds of things, just makes screwy results, right? But in this case, having a turnout that's comparable to a 2014 general election, an off year, but still where there's a statewide race happening, I actually don't see any reason why the general composition of the electorate won't basically be the same in November. And so I think that it wouldn't be that surprising to see the results basically be again within a couple of points. And it comes back to then at that point about mobilizing pockets of voters and organizing. On the other hand, we're not going to see like the $4 million of money that the Congressional mm-hmm. Leadership Fund and other Republican aligned groups threw at this race in the last couple of weeks. We're not going to see Donald Trump coming in and appearing with Troy Balderson. I would think that, I mean, I guess you might see him because Ohio seems to hold like a special place in his heart. But on the other hand, Republicans have a lot more congressional districts in other places that they'd probably be better served spending their time and resources in. So I don't, you know, you kind of think through it, and obviously this is just prognosticating and speculation, but I basically think it's going to be essentially the same result, and it's all going to come down to organizing.
Yeah, and I think the one wild card would be what Rich mentioned, though. I mean, we've talked about it, like the student vote and all that, and how young people are feeling. Is this a change election for young people to get back into the game or not? But I mean, young voters are unreliable. There's no way to say, oh, yeah, of course they're going to turn out.
Youth, you can't rely on them.
I know. The those lackadaisical youth.
You know, there is one group of voters that's pretty reliable, and I haven't looked at this yet, but what I've seen in elections that aren't a presidential election year, if there's a big levy issue on a local school, that'll really drive up turnout in particular areas. And I haven't looked at this, but it would be interesting to know, are there local issues that would drive people to the polls in some of these less populated areas of Muskingum County and Morrow County and Richland County that are very strong Republican, that's going to bring people to the poll in addition to this race? Then I guess the other thing we don't know is this governor's race going to get people excited? It seems like the Senate race is a little fizzling on excitement at this point, but maybe that'll change. But I mean, are there any other factors to get people out there? But oftentimes, it's odd. Sometimes looking at past elections, you say, why did this county have a huge turnout? And then you realize it's one of these smaller counties in Ohio that has one or two school districts, and they both had a big school levy on the ballot.
That's another good point about this, though, is that this is, you know, like Andrew said, it was a very special election. And that means that it was the only election that was happening, so everyone was laser-focused on this. Do you think that, like, I guess I asked the question, what side is going to be able to keep that laser focus on? You know, are Danny supporters going to say, like, we need to keep laser focused on this because we're going to win? Or do Troy Balderson supporters kind of like say, oh, breathe a sigh of relief, like, oh, we got it. You know, it's what happens to the presidential party every year. That's basically what happens. They win the presidency, and then there's a little bit of blowback because they kind of think, oh, we got our guy. Okay, we can take this next one off. Do Republicans end up taking the actual midterm off itself while Democrats kind of stay, like, in the zone and keep going?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. And I guess a lot of it's going to depend on what happens between now and November. But you have to assume that Democrats are pretty pumped up and angry, and so it's always easier to be mad at something and be motivated by that than it is to sort of, once you already got the car, like, what do you do with it? If you're a dog chasing a car, you catch the car. So, you would think that the enthusiasm sort of momentum would be in favor of the Democrats, but the more people that show up to vote in this district, just because of the way it's made up, you have to assume it's going to trend a little bit more Republican.
There's this theory out there, too. Say the Supreme Court nomination, does that go through? Is it going to happen in October? Is that going to, rally up one side or the other? Or any, who knows what with the Russian investigation or whatever? But we forget in the context of that, we always say this November election because that's election day, but voting starts in October. Mm. Well ahead of that, and a lot of people turn in their ballots, and maybe that doesn't affect turnout as much, but might affect, how people vote one way or the other if there are swing voters out there. And so this election is a lot closer than November.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting about this election, and this was an observation that Alex Burns from the New York Times, I think, articulated really well, and that's basically the Republican messaging in the 12th district started off on Troy Balderson, cut your taxes and balance the budget. And, Troy Balderson has grit and he's a good guy and just kind of a positive anodyne kind of message. Well, they've got, apocalyptic very quick. Their mail pieces showing cops like basically kicking down your front door and seizing your guns. Nancy Pelosi, of course, made a very liberal appearance and was very popular on direct mail pieces and stuff like that. They started talking about abortion. So it's basically these negative campaigning tactics on really big wedge issues. So it'll be interesting to see if moving forward, if Republicans even bother starting off with like the tax reform positive message, or they're just going to kind of go slash and burn negative and try to basically make a base play like throughout the country. So I guess, it's not clear what the best strategy would be, but I thought that was really striking about this race.
I'd be curious about the political brains in the room, Andrew and Seth, on this one. On one way, you hear nationally, you keep hearing, oh, this was a district that Trump won by 10 percentage points, and look how close it is. All the Republicans should be scared. And I say, well, wait a minute. This is an open seat. This isn't Tiberi running, who established himself there. So how much does this translate into the other seats? So that's one way to look at it. Say, well, maybe 10 points is kind of overstated if it brings it down. But then the other way, I don't know how to answer this, but people that aren't like us and those who would take the time listening to a political podcast, how many people really know who their congressman is or congresswoman or know about a candidate? Are they really just voting Republican or Democrat? So I don't know. I guess you can make that argument either way about how much a 10-point swing means.
Well, I think what's important to kind of take away from the 12th district itself is that you know, these special elections, they don't necessarily point to the topple of one party. Like, it's not a given that everything's going to be just upended and there's going to be this, you know, swing of, you know, 60 seats or something like that. That's probably not going to happen, like, frankly. But what you are seeing is you're seeing a trend to where, you know, if T. Berry had run for this seat again, he's probably safe. He's an incumbent. He's been there a long time. But what you're seeing is some of those more marginal districts, you know, Andrew touched on this a second ago, that there are something like 70 more competitive districts than this one in the country. That's 70 seats. And this one was decided by this close. Now, granted, you know, they could laser focus on this and be like, hey, this is for all the marbles kind of thing, even though the winner of this race is only going to serve for about, 5 months. But when you start seeing that sort of shift really taking place, that's when you start getting worried about, maybe you're not worried about a plus 11 district, but you might be worried about a plus 2 district. You might be worried about a plus 5 district even. And if you haven't, you know, once you get enough of those seats, well, that's enough to push it over the edge. You get Capital Letter. It's the must-have daily read for State House happenings. 5 mornings a week, Cleveland.com provides a daily intelligence briefing filled with succinct, timely information. It's perfect for people, businesses, and organizations that care about decisions made by lawmakers, the governor, and all of state government. From breaking news to rumblings in the rotunda, if you're not getting Capital Letter, you're missing out. For more information, visit cleveland.com/capitalletter. That's cleveland.com/CAPITOLLETTER. Andrew, you brought up a good point a second ago about the messaging in this race. And, you know, I noticed it actually the day after the election, Steve Chabot came out with a negative ad against Aftab Purival. And it seems like that is really the only sort of tactic that has worked in some of these races, is just to completely go negative. I'm thinking that's basically the strategy we're going to see now, is go negative, pound negative, go as hard as you can and just constantly do it. What do we think of the efficacy of that kind of strategy, especially in some of these swingier districts?
I think, you know, if we're just talking about Ohio, I mean, we have pretty much zero competitive congressional districts. And so if I'm a Republican trying to hang on to those 12 seats that they have right now, you're not really making a positive argument for yourself, because you have to just basically assume that your average voter in that district is inclined to support a Republican. What you have to do is present the other side as being an unviable or an unacceptable alternative. And so in Chabot's district, for example, Aftab has, we were talking about this, very high name recognition within the Hamilton County part of that district. But there's Warren County, there's those other outlying counties along the Ohio River who have no idea who he is. So he has a chance actually to define him. And, you know, so the Aftab's commercial says, like, my name means sunshine or whatever it is, which it does. But their ad from Chabot was like, it might mean sunshine, but he's shady, you know. And so it's dumb and, you know, it's kind of glib and stuff like that. But they do have an opportunity to just try to immediately define him in a negative way. And I expect to see that play out across the state.
I guess I'm curious. I don't see it necessarily working all that well, though, when you need to be able to pump people up to keep you in office and all that. I think it actually runs the risk of sort of turning people off, like, well, okay, we heard the negative things when you were, you know, saying them for 8 years or however long it was, and now you're in power and it's still just the negatives. I mean, I think that's one reason you saw, you know, tax cuts, they just didn't work in the 12th district at all. Nancy Pelosi, I think you can make an argument that maybe it kind of did, but not really. I mean, when you consider the gains that O'Connor made, I'm going to guess that the thing that really pushed him over was probably the John Kasich endorsement and maybe the Donald Trump visit coming. I mean, but John Kasich might not endorse in every race, and Donald Trump, sure enough, is not going to get to every single district in the country.
I don't think it's a great move to just go full negative, but it might be their best move, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's just really, it's a matter of, opinion, or I guess we'll have to see what plays out.
So, as we mentioned, Aftab down in the first district, Aftab and Chabot, that's probably going to be the next target for Democrats in this state to kind of flip a district. I did a piece that looked at some of the other races that could be in play. I kind of want to get your guys' opinion of them. I'm looking at that race down in the first. I'm looking at Dave Joyce versus Betsy Rader. up there in Northeast Ohio, kind of stretching over to Ashtabula, Geauga County, that kind of area. I'm looking at Mike Turner down in Dayton against Teresa Gasper. And I think even this district going forward, the Ohio 12th, all look like they actually could feasibly be in play. Now, Rich, you did a big project on gerrymandering a while ago. I'm wondering what you think of the voter profiles of those districts and if there's, you know, anything to glean from that.
Well, each of the districts that you mentioned there had some strong Democratic areas, but they were designed to be overall Republican. I mean, you're talking about like part of Dayton or on the eastern suburbs eastern suburbs of Cleveland, not in Cuyahoga County, but to east of there. So there's potential there. But when they did this, when the Republicans had full control back in 2011 and drew these maps, what they used to decide what would be a safe seat was, you know, big profile races, like, say, presidential races and so forth, like McCain and so forth. So they were going on history. Now, it's a different Republican Party now. Those Republicans that were pre-Trump, it's a different Republican Party. So I guess that raises the possibility of a dynamic change, say, in these suburban areas that we've seen, because they were basing on past election results and what the party had been like for 10 or 20 years to draw the district. So I guess that opens up a possibility. It's still a huge hurdle to overcome to flip one of these districts, because they were designed to be as safe could possibly be at map drawing time for 12 Republicans and 4 Democrats. It's interesting to me when you go through and list that. I'm going back to the non-incumbent running. Did the Democrats do something wrong not to be considered in your list of competitive districts of, you know, the Renacci's former seat, the 16th?
So looking at, you know, I think on paper that should be a competitive district.
And but it was the first time it ran with Betty Sutton.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you look, though, you've got Anthony Gonzalez, kind of a hometown hero who, you know, came back. He's got some celebrity about him. People know who he is, and he's been able to raise a boatload of money. You look at some of these other districts. You look at Danny. Danny was able to raise a lot of money. You look at some of these other special elections. They were able to raise quite a bit of money. You look at some of these other districts I'm talking about. All the candidates in that race, they can raise some money. The interesting thing about the 16th is the Democrat in that race just cannot raise any money. I think to date she's raised like, I think in the second quarter, I believe she raised $21,000. And $21,000 is probably just not enough for you to win a congressional race, especially when your campaign owes, you know, you another like 30.
But is that a failure of the party not to help prop her up if she's not raising on her own? When I'm looking at, like, say, the surprise a couple of years ago in Virginia with Cantor or whatever, you know, you get these candidates come out of woodwork, and again, are people voting, or they're voting on national issues and there's a D on the ballot and an R? It just seems like this one's been ignored.
Yeah.
I guess it's kind of that age-old debate, like how much is the party necessarily supposed to do versus how much is the candidate supposed to do? Actually, if you look at a lot of these special elections, the party hasn't done a whole lot in any of them. I mean, the DCCC did come in, you know, kind of late to O'Connor's campaign, but most of it has been kind of the campaign organization itself is doing it.
Yeah, I wrote about this a little bit last year when the primary was kind of shaping up in Ohio 16 without any obvious frontrunner on the Democrat side. And what I found then was that the state party was kind of stung by what happened in 2014, where they basically cleared the field for a bunch of candidates, namely Ed Fitzgerald, who ran for governor. Well, Fitzgerald lost by a historic margin of 30 points, right? Somewhere around there. And so the then party chairman was basically deposed, and they replaced him with David Pepper, who said that, well, we're going to not be heavy-handed with these districts and these races. We're going to let candidates kind of let the voters decide, let the candidates, you know, emerge and let chips fall where they may. So they've been very reluctant to get involved. And then locally, the Cuyahoga County parties had some organizational issues for a long time, which includes the corruption scandal and the aftermath. But also, I think that they focus a lot on, we have a very Byzantine system of ward leaders, and we have like 58 suburbs, all of which have their own Democratic club and stuff like that. So I find that the local Democrats sometimes get a little bit more concerned about their internal politics than they do kind of about some of this more like, you know, meat and potatoes organizational kind of stuff. So the net effect is that we had a candidate go through without really raising any money. And now that we're in the general, I mean, I'm not exactly sure if it's the book has been written that, you know, we don't know for sure that somebody won't come in and help her out from the state level. From the national level, again, I think Ohio doesn't really benefit from the fact that we've got congressional seats in California and Pennsylvania and Texas and places like that that are probably a smarter play for them. So you know, maybe at some point I'll do another story basically sizing up the fact that, hey, like, the Democrats basically seem to be waving the white flag in this district that should be competitive on paper. So, but yeah, I mean, to answer your question, Rich, I think it's a failure of organizing from the parties. And then I guess, you know, there's blame to go around with the candidate, too.
I'm fascinated by the success, apparently, at least on the fundraising side, and the votes so far through the primary of Gonzalez, too, though. Okay, he did play football at Ohio State. But he wasn't the biggest star in the world. He wasn't the quarterback. It's not like he was a multi-All-American. He was good enough to go on and play in the NFL, but he really had no tie after here. After he left Ohio State, he's California, moved back in time to just this year to establish his residency to run. And like I say, he wasn't like the quarterback. That's,
right, and it's not like LeBron player. James he
was,
running or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, he was like, I don't know, who the third or fourth player, the fourth player on the Cavs last year. I don't want to throw out a name because people will draw comparisons, but he wasn't star number one, two, or three, but he was a good player. But he's been able to have the success that we know of so far, both at the primary and, as you said, in the fundraising.
Yeah, he's raised money. I mean, he's definitely not an invincible candidate or anything like that. It's just you got to put somebody up against him who can actually run a viable campaign.
Yeah, when he's outraised her 10-1 or something at this point, that's why, you know, just all those things kind of added up. It makes that district look very much not competitive right now.
But kind of broadly, though, you know, last week we had an episode basically kind of sizing up the year of the woman in Ohio. And that's just one of those things that is a bigger force than really in any one individual race. And so with these three congressional districts, at least, that look winnable for Democrats on paper, maybe, you know, there's Turner's district, Joyce's district, and the 16th district. There are women candidates in all three of those. Mm-hmm. And Gasper and Rader have both raised a good amount of money, enough to be competitive and just run a viable campaign. I really think that, you know, I just can't see 16 becoming competitive with the spending levels where they are. But if there is this big force of women voters out there, I mean, that's going to be one of those storylines where maybe between the women factor and some of the suburban qualities of those districts, maybe that's enough of a macro play to actually help them push them across.
I think to add on to the kind of year of the woman argument, you could also add Brad Wenstrup's district down there, given, you know, in certain scenarios, I don't want to say that we should right now. It's basically the eastern half of Cincinnati, but it does stretch into a little more conservative kind of area along the river there. But it does have a woman, and not only, you know, Jill Schiller is running down there, and not just a woman, but a former Obama administration official. She worked for the Office of Management and Budget. She's one of only two congressional candidates in the state who he endorsed. So, you know, that could play a factor, although that district right now is probably, you know, out of bounds.
I will say I would be borderline shocked if any one of those three were to be beat. You know, you look at somebody like Steve Chabot, who's not the highest profile guy. He's not necessarily somebody who gets out a lot. Even somebody like Bob Gibbs, who's pretty well known. He's a former Farm Bureau guy, but he's not an energetic campaigner or anything like that. Well, so, but with Turner, he's a former Dayton mayor. He's on TV a lot. He looks the part of a congressman, basically, like central casting. He's on the House Intelligence Committee. He's very involved with military issues, with Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Obviously, military retirees are a huge factor there, and they're people who vote. And so I think Turner's good. I mean, Dave Joyce, he's a former county prosecutor. I feel like that's a profile of the kind of person that people tend to know just throughout the years because, you know, you're a county prosecutor. You get to do the drug bust. You get to do the murder cases and stuff like that and kind of just work the district. And then Wenstrup obviously had the situation where he rescued, literally saved people's lives in during the congressional Republican baseball game practice and just got a lot of profile from that way. So I just think the profile of those three candidates is pretty compelling. When you add that to the demographic makeup, it's hard to see them being beat.
Yeah, let's be clear that Democrats should not win any of these districts, frankly. They shouldn't win. They should not win a single one.
Goes back to the gerrymandering thing. Yeah.
They are by design made for Democrats to lose these districts. But the fact that they are being competitive, I mean, or that they look competitive, like they could be, is kind of one of the more fascinating. I mean, if you'd asked me a year ago if any of these races were even going to be kind of on the level, like, hey, maybe we should be paying attention to these, I would have said, no, you're crazy. There's no reason to. I mean, Rich probably knows better than anyone how these are carved up in a way that it doesn't lend itself to a close race. But now all of a sudden, since we have not just other special election results, but then even results from within our state, we can see kind of what Ohioans, how they voted in certain demographics. I do think it puts, like, especially that first district down there, Steve Chabot's seat, I think that is, it would not be a shocker to me if that one flipped. I think any of the other ones would, if it's more than one, I think it would be very surprising, and I think that would signify, even worse results nationwide for Republicans. It would take a massive blue wave. I guess that's really kind of the crux of this debate, right? Is the blue wave going to come here? What's it going to do?
Yeah. You know? The whole, like, red wave thing is just really stupid. Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, there's zero evidence of that.
I'm pretty confident in saying, no, we're probably not going to see a red wave, at least nationwide. I mean, you might have Republicans do well in Ohio because it's kind of designed for Republicans to do well right now as far as the congressional races go. But the question is, like, okay, if there, obviously there is some blowback. We saw that there was blowback in the 12th. How far does that blowback go? I mean, at an 11-point district and it gets that close, well, what does it do in a 7-point district like Chabot's? What does it do in a 7-point district like Turner's? What does it do in a, I believe, Dave Joyce says it's something like a 5-point district or somewhere around there. What does it do in those districts? And I guess the real answer is there's no way for us to tell until the ballots are counted. But
so what do you make of the fact that after the unofficial election results were announced and Balderson was declared the winner, that President Trump decided to spike the football and take credit for his victory? Like I said earlier, I've been a little bit puzzled by some of the end zone dancing that Republicans have been doing, although obviously you have to take a win where you get one. But do you think that Trump made a difference in that race, Seth?
If he did, I don't think he made a huge difference. But again, in this race, maybe a huge difference didn't matter. Maybe a small difference is enough to kind of turn someone. I personally think that John Kasich probably helped out a little more, that 11th hour endorsement, because he was able to keep those margins in some of those suburban districts. I guess you've got more voter profile than I do that Trump kind of kept steady and whatnot. But
did his thank you note get lost when Balderson was thanking everybody?
I did. Well, Kasich did. But I guess from a psyche standpoint, I guess I see maybe somebody who was teetering. Maybe they voted for Trump in 2016, and they're one of these voters who are teetering, like, oh, I held my nose. I didn't want to vote for Hillary Clinton. I wanted to vote for Donald Trump. But, a year and a half on, like, I don't know, I think I might have to vote for this Democrat. And, that person who is also a John Kasich voter sees Kasich come out and say, no, this is the guy. And I think that could have, allayed some of the fears that they might have had, those kind of on the fence voters, which I think we can obviously tell there were on the fence voters because this race was decided so close. So it's really hard to say. I don't think he whipped his voters up into a frenzy or anything to get out there and vote, but it might have made just enough of a difference to matter.
Yeah, and I tend to think that the big effect that he had was just making people aware that there's an election going on, because it's really asking a lot of people to, vote in May. They actually voted for both these candidates twice because of the weird dynamics of filling an unexpired term right before the general. So people had already, done a lot there. And so to get people out again, and some of the issue too, I guess, is letting people know what district they live in, because these districts are drawn in a way that's, it's really hard to tell. I mean, in Cleveland, I bet, after they redistricted and stuff like that, if you were to ask a lot of people, who's your representative, people probably still say Dennis Kucinich, even though he's been out of office for 10 years. But so it's always kind of difficult to figure out exactly where you are. And
it even confused the Board of Elections in Franklin County about where they were. They had to correct and had people placed in the wrong precinct.
But so, and then, it's the summer, vacation, all that stuff. So all of those factors kind of played where it'd be easy for people to just kind of sit this one out. And I think by Trump doing what he does best, which is commandeering the conversation, getting media attention, that kind of stuff, probably, helped, like you said, even if it's a marginal difference, still encouraging people to vote and enough to make difference in a close race.
Once all the votes are counted, this may very well be a win of fewer than 1,000 votes. So it's not hard to imagine that he could have got 1,000 people to show up out of an election where there are 200,000 votes cast. But at the same token, I guess maybe he could have gotten some Democrats to come up and say, I'm tired of Trump, I got to stop this guy too. Right. So I don't know.
That's kind of been what I'm wondering, is because you do see such a fervor, I guess, among, specifically the Democratic Party. I don't necessarily say all Democratic voters, but among the Democratic Party, that I think it probably kind of offsets a little bit. But then you do have, you know, the governor come in, and I think, you know, the Democratic Party has kind of been backing off attacking the governor a little bit, specifically because Danny O'Connor and the Rich Cordres of the world have really been sort of angling for that voter very openly. I mean, Rich Cordray is basically begging for Kasich voters to come over to him, and you know, Danny O'Connor was doing the same thing. One thing I do think that is worth pointing out in a couple of the districts that we talked about, specifically in Mike Turner's district and Dave Joyce's district, is they have a little, you saw Troy Balderson really hug the administration during his race. You know, Mike Turner and Dave Joyce have actually been one of the more kind of vocal Republican critics, or two of the more vocal Republican critics of the president. Both of them didn't vote for the healthcare repeal. Both of them have been pretty quick to, you know, condemn the president for things like Charlottesville or anything like that.
Relatively speaking, yes.
Right. But
we're not talking about like profiles and courage here.
Among Republicans, right. I should say. And so I don't know if that'll play any factor at all. I think, like Rich said, you know, not many people know who their congressman is, so maybe it doesn't make a difference at all, and I'm thinking too much about it. But I do think that if they have the argument to make is, oh, I'm the independent Republican, which is, you know, maybe what people are looking for, they might be able to kind of stave off some of the wave.
So you mentioned earlier the thank you note that Troy Balderson forgot to give Kasich on election night. I just sort of, as an aside, apropos of not a whole lot, but talking, you know, you prompted me to think about this when you were talking about them kind of laying off Kasich a little bit. Bob Poduchik, who ran Trump's campaign in 2016, ran Rob Portman's Senate campaign before that. Now he's the co-chair of the Republican National Committee, so he's definitely had a pretty fast rise, even though he's been a player in Ohio politics for a long time. Retweeted somebody's observation on election night that Balderson forgot to thank Kasich, and I thought that was really funny. So I just wanted to say that. That's all.
All right. Any closing thoughts before we wrap up?
Well, I have a closing question for you, Seth.
Okay.
So tell me about the beer and pizza situation at the O'Connor party.
Oh, that is one thing that Jeremy and I did note, is that there was a massive amount of pizza at O'Connor's party. I didn't get any, of course. You know, we don't take those things.
You're
but
such a paragon of integrity, Seth.
I am, actually. But Balderson apparently had, like, bacon-wrapped dates and those kinds of things, ooh, you know? So, yeah, very classy food. However, Balderson did have the cash bar, whereas Danny O'Connor had kegs and a full wine list and all that.
Hashtag free stuff, right?
Yeah, I feel like he may have gone back in time and found a junior year of college me and decided that this is what was going to be on the menu.
So maybe he was just tempting you, you know, wanted to put your journalistic integrity on the line. It was like a specific challenge for you.
I believe I succeeded, though. So in fairness, though, it was Bud Light, so it was easy to, you know, resist.
So in sense of that old question for voters is, who would you like to have a beer with? I guess if I was a voter, I'd like to have a beer with somebody that's giving it to me.
Or you could have a beer with me.
There you go.
All right, thank you, everyone, for listening to this election recap. We will be back to interviewing regular guests next week. And as always, thanks for tuning into Ohio Matters.